Kevin Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is founder and senior acoustic consultant of the innovative Smart Studio, Jim Dunn. But first of all, I don't know if you heard, but Billboard has some new charts. Yeah, they have a weekly top songwriters chart and a weekly top producers chart. So you might be thinking, how are they determining who's the top songwriter and who's a top producer? Well, it's actually based on the total number of points that they attribute to songs on other charts. So in other words, if you produce a song that's on five different charts, or you produce five different songs that are on one chart, doesn't matter. It's the number of contributions that you have, and they have a point system, and that's what puts you on the chart. Same with songwriters. Now, the very first week, guess who's on top of both charts? Well, Finneas O'Connell and Billie Eilish. Of course, Finneas is Billie's brother, who's also her producer. Billie Eilish is probably one of the hottest acts, if not the hottest act in the business right now. And it would figure that they would top each chart. So there's a lot of people that are looking at this skeptically, thinking, why do we need this? It turns out that Billboard is having a lot of pushback on its charts recently. And people are saying, well, wait a second, we have charts on just about every streaming service. Why do we need Billboard charts? They're kind of irrelevant anymore. You know what? They were, especially when they're based on sales. They're no longer based on sales, although that's a component. It's based on a lot of different things, on a social component, on the amount of streaming, on YouTube views. So the charts, especially the major ones, the Hot 100, try to take all of that, an artist's total musical presence, into consideration. Billboard, to give them credit, has been really trying to stay relevant and really trying to make their charts relevant. Now, of course, the history of Billboard is the fact that it goes back to the days way before music, when it was mostly about circus entertainment and vaudeville and things like that, where we're looking at the box office for these things. And it was mostly for the wholesale business. So it's the people that advertised with these. And then, of course, then it was mostly for record labels in the days of sales, vinyl sales and CD sales, trying to get record labels to advertise to retailers, telling them how cool they were and how cool the new artists are and how well the new release was doing. It's all irrelevant now because it doesn't work like that anymore. And now what's happening is it's become more of a outward-facing, more of a retail magazine. So it's not so much for the industry, it's more for everybody else. Even though the industry, especially record labels, seem to place chart position way, way higher than maybe they should. It's almost like a contest within record labels of who has the most artists on the charts and who has the highest positions. When it seems like the only people that really care about this are people that work for record labels, and in many cases the artists, especially if they're major artists. So anyway, you might be interested in these two new charts, top songwriters and top producers. If not, I don't blame you. Just go and look at the Apple Music charts, the Spotify charts, the Tidal charts, and you might get as much information as you need. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now, here's an interesting news item. The Australian version of Homeland Security intercepted a whole bunch of speakers, Nexo speakers, which are sound reinforcement, that were packed with drugs. Almost 2 tons of drugs that were worth about $835 million. It was all meth, with a little bit of heroin. These were fake PS15R2 speakers that are basically just a small 15-inch speaker with a horn packed with drugs. No speaker components, just drugs. It turns out that these weren't true Nexo speakers. If you're not into sound reinforcement, you might not be familiar at Nexo, but Nexo is a fairly large speaker manufacturer. They were bought by Yamaha a number of years ago. They're French originally, but highly regarded. One of the problems is the fact that all of a sudden, Nexo speakers and Yamaha speakers and Sennheiser, JBL, Shure, all of those companies are having their gear cloned in Mpeg City in China. Yeah, there's a couple of companies there that specialize in doing counterfeit speakers and microphones. For some reason, they don't do studio gear, I guess because there's not enough of it sold, so they concentrate more on sound reinforcement stuff, and Nexo is one of them. It turns out that these might have been Chinese knockoffs, but the shipment with all the drugs originated in Bangkok. This isn't the only one, though. In fact, not that long ago, there was 1.9 tons of meth and heroin that was captured at the port of Los Angeles on its way to Australia. And these were in fake Alphasonic enclosures. Once again, another speaker manufacturer that does sound reinforcement speakers. Now, again, it's funny because I would think they would use the big line array boxes. And in fact, they're not. They're using the like single 15 with the horn box, which is big enough, but not that big. And I guess they figure there's plenty more of those. Usually the cost of a real speaker goes in the neighborhood of $2,200 or so. So it's not that expensive. I guess they figured that they wouldn't get Homeland Security or Customs looking at these. But in fact, now they have on two different continents. You know, it's funny because I can think way back into the 70s when I was playing in a band and we were carrying our pot around when it was way, way illegal. And it wasn't much, believe me, but we would put it in our Voice of the Theater cabinets, the Altec Voice of the Theaters, because there's lots of room in there. And that would elude the police. And of course, they didn't have the sophisticated methods of looking for it like they have these days. But it worked then, doesn't work now. Jim Dunn has over 30 years' experience in the acoustics and noise control industry and has worked in a number of different roles in related industries. His previous work experience ranges from on-site construction activities to recording studio design and build to electroacoustic equipment supply and install to company management. Jim also worked for a number of years in the world-famous Windmill Lane Studios, one of the premier recording facilities in Ireland, which catered to clients like U2, The Waterboys, and Kate Bush. In his role as a senior acoustic consultant at Smart Studio, Jim marries his theoretical knowledge with his practical experience in order to implement this very cool new way of studio building. In the interview, we talked about the technical aspects of Smart Studio, the typical build time, what a deconstruction is like, speaker calibration, and much more. I spoke with Jim via Skype from the Smart Studio offices in Dublin. First of all, talk about Smart Studio.
Okay. Smart Studio is a bit. It's a response to what I found in the industry in regards to the quality of so-called studios, rooms that people call studios, and in finding that they're very disappointing, and also thinking that people should know better than they seem to know. But you know, life is what life is, as such. So. It's one element is endeavoring to you know, without being too socialist and what have you, but the idea is that, you know, anybody can have a high quality studio. Years ago, it was to some degree it was based around these high profile acousticians, and they're, you know, and they did an excellent job and what have you, and but it was all quite difficult to achieve in terms of pricing. So, all that process is quite an expensive process. So that was one side of it. And then the other side of it was that we've seen ourselves working on a couple of projects where we had done the acoustic design and we're absolutely disappointed with the final outcome. And to the point where we question our own acoustic design and what have you. And we couldn't identify any obvious flaws. So part of it is that, especially in the modern construction industry, the people who are building these studios are not people who build studios for a living, okay? They tend to be a main contractor, and in a certain area of the building, there's going to be a studio. And then it's all worked out based upon a program and a package. And lots of people, there's a design done, and then there's lots of people brought in. The studio design is broken up, and you do this bit, and you do that bit, and you do that bit. And there's a project manager, and there's lots of, you know, corporate entities around the place running it. But the reality is nobody on the team knows what a studio should look like, and more importantly, what it should sound like as such. So therefore, modern construction techniques are not conducive to building good studios, number one. And the guys, while everybody's working to their best endeavors, and nobody denies or doubts that, if you don't exactly know what you're building, it's very hard to know if it's right or wrong as such. So therefore, we wanted to take control of that particular, of the complete project. And again, I suppose it's one of these things, Smart Studio is a reflection of my working life and my various educational qualifications and experiences. And one of them, which has been really instrumental in the Smart Studio thing, has been the fact that I worked with my dad in a construction industry a long time ago. Worked with him a long time ago, and I ran out of it saying, I don't want to know anything about this construction industry and what have you. Went off to do the electronic engineering, worked in the recording studio, set up my own business selling the equipment, then went to college and actually qualified later in life in the area of acoustics. But you know what? The one skill that has been core to developing Smart Studio and to be the acoustics business was the experience I gained in the construction industry. But there you go. It meant that I'm not afraid of building sites. And I don't mean that that's probably a rather exaggerated phrase, but they don't faze me. Whereas, I've been on building sites. I've seen how things go together. I've seen what you can do, what you can't do. And I've seen how you kind of, you manage certain things as such. And that's been really key in the sense of taking on Smart Studio. And the fact that, we have a CNC machine just in the warehouse behind me here. We're the only acoustics company in the world, I would think, with a CNC machine.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah, we took it on. We said, we're going to do this here. We're going to have to make these things. And we had to buy the CNC machine, and we had to learn how to use it. But the great thing now is if we come up with an alternative design or we come up with a new idea, well, you know what? It's only one sheet of plywood that might get wasted. So, there's a lot of return for that effort and energy and that effort to learn all these skills. Because now it gives us capabilities way above and beyond, what will be available. All the capabilities are available, but they're all in small cellular packages. We actually pull them together into one integrated package.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. But first of all, something that you said resonated with me here about the construction people not being aware of what they're building. And it's certainly true. One of the things in Southern California, though, for a time, there were so many studios being built that there were actually dedicated companies that were really good at it. But this was kind of back in the heydays of the 80s and 90s, and, there's not as many studios. Yeah, it's certainly the case, I know, where, you'll have all these contractors and they're not all sure what to do. And it's important because if they don't do it right, then, in fact, you're going to have deterioration in the isolation or, the acoustics of the room. Yeah.
Indeed, and it's acoustics is all about detail, and it's not the 99% you get right, it's the 1% you get wrong is the problem, and we have a little in-house joke here. Our little joke is that no builders have been hurt in the construction of this studio.
Jim, who are your clients?
Okay, our clients are initially we certainly designed it for the sound for pictures people, because the guy's doing dubbing, doing revoicing, doing ADR, doing, sound for pictures, because the reality was those guys still have a budget, because in the world of video, if a 10% budget for audio is very generous, and they've also got a franchise in the sense that they have got programs to get on air, they've got slots to fill, they've got advertisements sold. So therefore, there's a valid business model there, which is active all over the world. we found with the music boys that since they can't sell you a CD anymore, they've lost their business model and what have you. But funny enough, now we've found ourselves working with some studio people, audio studio people, music studio people as such, you know, which is a great surprise and a great joy in its own right. But it was very much initially designed for, I suppose, the marketplace we're looking at from an Irish point of view is the UK marketplace in the Soho area, where you've got a lot. It's a hub for media activity. It is. All the major record companies there, all the major film companies are there. All the people who supply services to those companies are all in that area. And when you looked at the likes of the Soho marketplace, it's a very, or the Soho geography, it's a very small, narrow roads, very narrow laneways. And when you get into the building, it's very hard to get materials up and down the building. So that's what made me think about modular, and that's what made me think about the idea of making it sort of bite-sized pieces, which will make it easier to get the materials in. And number two, actually give you the option to get them back out again, because one of the great side benefits of Smart Studio is that you can actually take it with you.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, it feeds into the investment decision making process. You know, what residual value do we have from our investment? And it also feeds into the environmental world as well too, in the sense that things don't have to be trashed. You know, it's got a value above and beyond just its first initial install, as far as it goes. So therefore, they're all important features. Especially the environmental one is becoming much more prominent and much more high profile in the modern world we're living in, as such. You know, so the Sound for Pictures people were the kind of guys. And again, what you find with them, again, having worked in that business, I know what happens is that deadlines get, target dates are set. But people don't make decisions until very, very late in the day. And then they really want a quick deployment. So therefore, the Smart Studio, we're the only people in the world in the studio game who can say to you, well, we probably got half of your studio in stock.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, because if we're not out building or installing studios, we're just making the components here. They don't have a shelf life. They don't have an upgrade situation. They're passive as far as it goes. And, you know, so we're you know, day zero or day one on site is not day one of the project from our point of view. It's day one on site. But there's been day minus X preceding that, whereby we were able to you know, make the components. And then that's the beauty of the design, is that it's very robust. It's, we use the same modular system, you know, on all jobs. And even to the point whereby somebody said, well, could you not make a Smart Studio light? And I said, well, we could, but you know, all we're going to do is save maybe 6 or 7 inches on a side panel of a module. And, you know, that doesn't contribute any real saving, yet it would really impede the performance of the room. So we kind of have something that is just there.
Yeah.
And it works. We can make it. I suppose the first thing we can say about it is Smart Studio works acoustically. Number two, we can make it. Number three, we can install it. And number four, we're on the sales push now. But being the person I am, I wasn't going to push on the sales until such point in time as I was sure about 1, 2, and 3. And in that order, number one, it works acoustically. Number two, we can make it. And then number three, we can install it.
I don't know if you can see behind me, but the tube traps.
Yep. I see them there. Yep.
I've had these for maybe 20 years, but I bought them just for the reason you're talking about, because I knew they were portable. And I could take the acoustics with me wherever I went. So they're not the most efficient passive devices or acoustic devices I've ever seen. But on the other hand, they do the job.
They do. And they're portable. Indeed. Yes, exactly. Indeed, indeed, indeed. Yes.
That being said, let's talk about, you say it's modular. I assume that there are wall modules and you have corner modules that would make all this work. Are the bass traps built into these modules, or are they separate?
No, the whole idea behind it is the module is a multi-dimensional acoustic entity as such. The back of it, first of all, it's a frame that stands up on the floor independently. Number two, it is the back of the module has a lot of high-density gypsum board. You'd call it dry lining, or you'd call it rock, sheetrock.
Sheetrock, yes.
Yeah, and we would also have other components in there, such as dead sheet, which is basically a limp mass material. So we make up the back of the module is a very high density sound insulation element. The middle of the module is basically an acoustic chamber. And then the front of the module is where we have a choice between what we call 2D diffusion or bass absorption. So therefore, that is what the module is. Now, the 2D diffusion is something we use a lot of because our objective is to retain some of the acoustic energy in the room. Mm. It's so easy to absorb the mid-high frequencies and end up with an unbalanced and overpronounced low-frequency component. And that's the easiest thing in the world to do, and it happens regularly, it does. So what we try and do is actually retain the acoustic energy in the room, and that's why we use diffusion. Now, it's a light diffusion. It's not quadratic diffusion, which is very particular, and you've got to be very careful about where you use quadratic diffusion. Now, I would probably use quadratic diffusion in a studio environment because it'll allow me to tailor and play around with sounds. But when you're in the control room where you need to hear accurately the actual sound from the speakers, you need to be very careful about quadratic diffusers and using them as such. So we use 2D diffusion, and that helps us retain the acoustic energy in the room, but we still achieve a very comfortable low frequency response. So therefore, what's happening is the people working in the room they don't become fatigued. You know what in a room that makes you tired is a lot of high frequency absorption, and you're okay. And first thing in the morning, and the next thing you know, you're working your way through the daytime. In the mid afternoon, you're a little bit fatigued. You keep on working because the nature of this business is you got to get the job done. You finish maybe 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night. You come in the morning and you're horrified to hear how the mix sounds as you went further through the day. What's been happening there is your ears have been subject to what we call temporary threshold shift. Hearing being a dynamic organ, it actually shifts to try and compensate for lack of information. So what happens is that your hearing shifts slightly. You're mixing to that new calibration that your earring has taken on, and it's not accurate. And when you come back in the morning with fresh ears, it sounds very, very, doesn't sound like what you thought it would sound like as such.
Yeah.
So therefore, you end up in a scenario where you possibly have to remix maybe an hour's worth of material and what have you. So it's not the place to be from anybody's point of view. It's not a good place to find that your hearing thresholds are shifting from another point of view. And the diffusion, also from a third point of view as well, too, by keeping the energy in the room and not absorbing it, what you find is you don't have to turn the volume dial up as much on the mixing desk. Mm. Now, that has, again, going back to my electronic engineering days, that means you're not running all the gear as hot. It's running more in its linear zone because electronic equipment has got sort of, you know, three zones. It's not at low level, it's not linear. There's a mid area where it's very linear, and at high level, it's not linear again. So you really want to keep it in this linear area in the middle. So therefore, by not having to turn the volume up, it's operating in its intended operational zone. It's not getting overheated. You're not going to get premature aging on the voice coils. You're not going to get the amplifiers, you know, maybe being, again, getting premature aging and such. So the whole idea of using diffusion is there's lots of really good reasons for it. And our philosophy is simple. Our rooms don't have a sound. The only sound you hear in our room is the sound of the speakers you spent your time, effort, and money in auditioning. So we want to make sure you hear your speakers in an environment that is neutral and unobtrusive is what it is as such, you know. So that's kind of our philosophy behind the acoustic, the room acoustic element. So we use a lot of low frequency bass energy trapping, and that's built in as part of the wall module. So we have bass trapping on all five sides. The only place we don't have bass trapping is on the floor. Hmm. Because even the diffusion panels that we use, they are panels. So at low frequency, actually act as panel resonators. So again, we're trying to use multiple features in the system. Or the diffuser, the front panel, the diffuser panel is a diffuser at one level. It's a low frequency absorber at another level as such. The bass frequency absorber is actually is just tuned down to about 63 hertz. Like our rooms will give you a consistent 0.25 to 0.3 of a reverb time at 63 hertz. Even the small rooms, even the VO booths don't resonate. You walk into a VO booth, and we've had some really compromised sizes, i.e., I think 1.2 wide by 1.8 long. I mean, with a door making up one wall and a quite a large piece of glass on another wall.
Yeah.
And the room still doesn't resonate as such, you know?
Wow.
So the whole idea is about a very robust and a very stable design that is scalable from the small VO boot all the way up to the larger rooms. Now, there is a limit to how large we can go with our rooms. We are not going to be building the big dubbing theatres because that's not our game, and we recognise that that's not the marketplace we're designing for. That's a conventional build. That's kind of, you know, that is your contractor on board with an acoustician basically living on his shoulder, making sure he is doing it right for the duration of the project as such, you know.
Yeah.
But again, the design we have, the one real fallout from it is that the rooms have a very consistent sound. You can walk into one of the, in fact, there's a building in Manchester called the White Tower. And on the seventh floor, we've got two quite decent sized dubbing rooms and a VO booth. And on the floor below, the sixth floor, we have a smaller mixing room. And I have the greatest joy in life is bringing people into those rooms and walking them in. And I say nothing. They just listen without any even program playing back. They listen, just they know in their own ears the sound in the room. So I bring them all the way around the two rooms up on the seventh floor, and then I walk them down to the room on the sixth floor. And there's a consistency in the sound temperature, the sound quality. You're not finding, oh gosh, this sounds like this and that sounds like that. Our rooms are consistent. And that's a big advantage, especially for the multi-room facilities where they start a session in room A and then they go to room C for dubbing and then they come back to wherever for mixing. A really interesting story. We did the BVE show in London there back in the end of February. We were speaking to one of the major manufacturers of speakers. And he was telling me that he has to be very careful when he goes around some of the rooms in his patch in the London area, because the sound in the one facility, room to room, is just so varied. So much so that he actually has to detune the good rooms so the bad rooms don't sound so bad.
Oof.
That to me was, oh my gosh.
Yeah, right.
That's just not right.
Tell me about the isolation, Jim.
Okay, isolation is there's multiple functions feeding into isolation. One is all our rooms are built in isolated floating floors.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets us off the structural floor onto an isolated base. The walls are then constructed off that on around the perimeter of that isolated floor, and the ceiling stroke roof actually sits on the wall. So therefore, none of our room, it's all room within a room, which is a classic way of achieving isolation. Okay, then. So now what we do is we always have a minimum of 200 millimeters between the back of our module and the next adjacent structure, the next wall, or it could be a wall or it could be a ceiling. Now, in some situations, that may be a block wall, a concrete block wall. Other situations, it may be into an open space. So then what we do there is we then actually would use a very high density, a high rated sound insulation wall buildup from your, you know, which would be recognizable to the guys who are doing the sort of the gypsum buildup systems, except we would use dead sheet in that to give us the low frequency extra performance. Now, when you're looking at high levels of sound insulation from room to room, it's the same business for us as it is for everybody else. You've got two options. One, you put maybe a block wall in the middle for mass, not necessary at all for the Sound for Pictures boys. Absolutely not. Their mix level is at 80 decibels at the mix position. So then, you know, that's what they're working to.
Yeah.
Or you increase the void between the back of our module and the next wall, and then you fill in that with a very high density rock wall, i.e. 120, 180 kg per cubic meter. Mm. And that's how you get your high levels of sound insulation. So in some situations, it's all very much site specific. In the middle of London, they don't want to know that it's going to be they're paying X number of pounds pounds per square meter or square foot, and then suddenly find a lot of that's lost in walls, you know, voids between walls.
Yeah.
In a large warehouse situation where you've got loads of room, hey, it doesn't matter. If the void is maybe a meter, so be it. Again, we know from our calculations, from our experience, that around about half a meter is optimum between the back of one module and the back of the next module. Going beyond that, the gains are fairly nominal. They're fairly, you know, they're not significant as such, you know. So that's how we do sound insulation. We do all those calculations, and we also obviously speak to our clients and find out what their intended program content is going to be, and find out what they're looking for.
Is there a typical room?
There's actually not a typical room. The beauty of the Smart Studio system was that when we had it all built and working, I sat down and I actually went through, I just put in a spreadsheet, and I went in basically 3 square meters, which would be about what? 3 square meters would be about 30 square foot. Would it be? Square meter is yeah.
Yeah.
Would it be? And I just built a whole series of rooms, 3 square meters bigger each time. So we go from 5 odd square meters up to 50 in about 16 steps of additional 3 square meters. So there's nothing typical. It can be any one of those sizes. You know, it's all based around, you know, one extra module here, one extra module there, right next to another module here. And it all just sort of scales up nice and simply. Now, we don't have to stick to the exact dimensions of the modules. We also have the function or the capabilities to reduce the size of a module for a custom module. But you'll find any customization is at the margins. It's still the core of the system is based around our 4 foot by 8 foot modules.
What is a typical, well, since there's no typical room, it's hard to say, I guess, but what would be the build time?
Okay, build time. Again, part of the motivation for the modular thing was that, you know, we didn't want to be making too many millionaires out of guys who own hotels. So we wanted to get in there quickly, get the job done, and get home again. So typical build time, I suppose you're looking at probably to be nothing less than 3 weeks, but you'd be building, you know, I couldn't, on a single room build, the maximum would be 6 weeks. Maximum would be 6 weeks on a single room build.
What does that include?
Okay, that includes getting to site. It includes the isolated floor, the walls, the ceiling. Now, depending on, you know, a lot of this is all very site specific. Somebody may have a room which is formed on 4 sides by 4 walls and a ceiling. So therefore they say, we want to put Smart Studio in here. So therefore all we're doing is putting the Smart Studio into that space. It's actually, it's already, the space is already created as far as it goes. In other situations, you find yourself where you're sort of, you're putting into the corner of a space, and you've got to build 2 more walls, one on this side and one on that side, to enclose a Smart Studio room. So it's all very site specifics, and sometimes, you know, building the external envelope walls is something we get the local guy to get his local contractor to do, because that's a very simple enough task. It's not that specialist. There's no, you know, once it's putting gyprock on gyprock, putting up a frame, that's not going to be a huge issue as such, you know, and it's probably cheaper for them to do that locally. So every job does have its very specific sort of set of circumstances that we need to review specific to that particular situation as such, you know.
Yeah, okay. How about HVAC?
Well, again, it's not that we want to be air conditioning engineers, but again, we know from our point of view, we have to take this on board. So there's 2 situations. One is we actually supply it and install it. Now, again, we've got our, what you see behind me here is my acoustics offices, whereby I've got my acoustic consultants, and we work on lots of projects, schools, hospitals, houses, colleges, theaters, music recording studios on another level and what have you. So therefore, we have a lot of expertise in terms of doing acoustic assessment on M&E systems. So we know, and again, obviously, because we know where we're coming from the studio business, we know that what an M&E contractor may consider quiet, we would consider it to be a howling gale.
Right.
So we have all the experience. We're like, we can look at a system and say, okay, give us a technical blurb on the AHU unit. Give us a technical blurb on the fan coil unit. Tell us what length of ducting it is. Give us the diameter of the ducting. Tell us what grills are on the end of it. And we can do an assessment, and we can tell you whether that will achieve spec or not. Or we actually take that job on ourselves and actually deal with it ourselves.
Okay. Now, You talked about how it's possible to take some of this with you. So what is a deconstruction like, and then a reconstruction?
Okay. Essentially speaking, a deconstruction would it's all finished when the room is when the shell's completed, it's all then lined with the fabric. So the fabric is on a tracking system, so that just is extracted off. You just pull that off as such. Beyond that, then your tracks are not really going to be useful because they're going to be spanning across modules. But your modules are fully demountable. The face panel, the sound insulation within the module, and the actual components that you're going to make up the module. So all the wall modules are deconstructible. The ceiling is deconstructible as well too. The floor probably not, because I think you may well be able to take away the isolating rubbers as far as it goes, but it's built up of horizontal sheets of gypsum board, and they don't tend to be good at, you know, deconstructing as far as it goes.
Right.
So therefore, probably the floor, but the doors will be removable, the windows will be removable, all of those components. What we would say to a client is, look, somewhere between 25 and 35% of your investment would be retained.
Okay.
So, for example, if you spent 100,000 euros on the studio, we'd be saying to you, 35,000 euros of that will be the kind of the economic figure in terms of what you're able to, you know, by the time you deconstruct, remove, and then reconstruct, you're probably at that kind of a rate as such, you know?
I see. See, I would have thought it would be higher somehow, since all the components are there.
Yeah, again, there's a labor component, which is, there's a labor component which is specific to the job on the day.
Sure. Got it. Okay, so let's talk about cost.
Okay. So we've got an actual, we've got two ways for people to get an idea on the cost of a studio. Again, we really want to furnish this information to people and not have them, like the traditional way of working at a cost is you get your architect, you get an acoustic consultant, he gets an M&E guy, he gets a quantity surveyor. They come up with a plan to and fro, and that takes its own sweet time and has its own cost associated with it. Eventually, you get to the point whereby they've agreed on a schedule of what they want to do. They then go to the market and they have X number of contractors bid for it, and you know that's the way that works. But straight away, you're actually into a very extended period of time, and you're also at a point in time where you've got costs which you're unaware of what the actual scale of them are. The beauty of Smart Studio is it's built on modules. I know what a module costs, and I just do X modules, Y modules, and I can actually very, very quickly return an accurate cost. Now, it'll be in a band. We're not going to give somebody an exact price because we need to see the site in advance to get it. You know, if it's in a warehouse and we can drive our truck in and we can take the material off and it's right there beside us, that means a less expensive job. If it's on the seventh floor of the White Tower and we got to bring the stuff into the basement and we got to get up on the lift and we got to, you know, there are issues like that we need to, which are site specific, and there's also issues around the air conditioning which are site specific as such.
Yeah.
But we do give a band price between X and Y. So therefore, you get some idea of where it's at. So on our Smart Studio Inc. website, you have the opportunity to give pass on some of your details to us, and then you can step in. And what we did there was, rather than say, okay, X meters by Y meters or X foot by Y foot, because a lot of people you're dealing with, they're not that... it's not their normal disposition to be talking in feet. So what we say, on-air studio, 3 people. We say TV production studio, X people. We say medium-sized dubbing suite, you know. So therefore, they can actually just pick what they think they need. There will be a physical size associated with that. Then they will see a band price from X to Y as a guide price. Now, we've also, that really does help make the decision-making chain along, because now if you're looking at a possible project, you can go to your local equipment supplier, give him a schedule of equipment. He'll tell you it can cost X, you know, to supply that equipment. You can go to your local system integrator and say, I want to put all this gear into that room there. How much will that cost? Now you got that figure. And now you've got a figure for your studio. So you've got a budgetary figure to tell you whether this actually is a runner or not.
Yeah, yeah.
As such, you know. And then beyond that, then we have another spreadsheet which we then share with people it gives us all the range of room sizes. So this is all down to, you know, dimensions as far as it goes. And that not alone gives you the internal dimension of the room, it gives you the actual size of the footprint of the Smart Studio, which is basically 10 inches deeper than the internals. So if you said to me that it's actually the room is 10 foot wide, I'd say, well, actually, the room is 10 foot wide, but the floor print of it is 10 foot plus 20 inches because we got two walls either end of it.
Sure.
And then what we do is we then give them another column which says this is the ideal site size. So to get a room of this size, you should be looking for a site of that size. Again, very useful information when you're going looking for a new premises for a new building. You can be quite specific with your real estate boys and say, look, this is what we're looking for. That's the sizes there. It just shortens the whole decision-making chain. It just means the thing runs a lot smoother as such, you know?
Sure. Jim, I saw that there was a speaker calibration component in this as well. So can you describe that?
Indeed. Again, the speaker calibration component is actually a very light touch because thankfully the rooms are so good acoustically speaking. You're not going to have to find yourself trying to sort of deal with all sorts of, you know, resonances and sounds in a room as such. So the speaker calibration is very much geared up for the boys in 5.1 and Dolby and what have you. And you want to anywhere in any room, no matter who builds it or who designs it, the sound can only be optimized for one particular position or one particular zone, and that's obviously where the guy is sitting with his fingers on the, you know, on the mixing desk with the faders. So it's also not always possible to put the 5.1, the back speakers, etc., the rear speakers and the subs where you want to put them. They have to go for lots of reasons where they have to go. So you need to ensure that we can calibrate for that mixed position, that the guy sitting at that or the girl sitting at that desk at that mixed position knows that what they're hearing is 100% accurate as such. So therefore, that's part of what we do. Now, again, it's when I go back to my early days back in Wimble Lane Studios, and we were using the white equalizers to try and tune. And the game was get the Clark Technic screen to be flat in our wonderful innocence. And we'd spend all day and tweaking it, and eventually we get it flat, and it would sound terrible.
Yep.
Absolutely terrible. But we're now in a much more advanced technological world whereby we've got some fantastic DSP units, all at very, very relatively affordable costs. And I suppose, like everything in life, these are all tools, and we see them as part of our toolbox. We don't see them as the solution. They are part of our toolbox. We got our passive toolbox, which is our Smart Studio. We got our and then we got our active tools, which is our mostly timing alignment as far as it goes. We really don't get down and dirty on trying to put any curves in on the speakers. We let the speakers speak for themselves. But, you know, whereas years ago those tools were very expensive and really didn't do what we thought they should do. Nowadays, there are tools, and so we enjoy using all of those components to ensure we get a calibrated mixing environment or a calibrated listening environment that is consistent room to room. You know, again, in the world of acoustics, calibration is a very important phrase. We have to calibrate the meters every 2 years. We got to calibrate them when we go to site with our field sound calibrator. So, you know, we come from that engineering discipline of wanting calibration and accuracy.
Sure. It sounds like you're just concentrating on the UK for now, but obviously if this is modular, then it's also scalable to other countries. Any plans on that?
Yeah, we do indeed. Yeah, we have very much plans in that area. Now, again, what we're very much doing at the moment is our target market is our home market here in Ireland, which has been surprisingly good to us, which I didn't think it would be, because it's a very small market. The UK is definitely buying into what we're doing. And then Europe is also, we've got some very interesting contacts from Europe, and we can look after that sort of range of countries from our own little base here in Dublin. Beyond that, then, we're actively looking at finding partners. We really need to find, probably the question is, are they audio partners or are they construction partners? You know, because they kind of need to be a bit of both. They need to be a bit of a hybrid, because that's what we are here. We're a bit of a hybrid company. You know, we got construction experience, we got acoustics experience, we got electrical experience, we got all the guys who work with me have trained as sound engineers, so we got that technical skill. and you know, we're all quite conversant on equipment and what have you. So we certainly do see a wonderful opportunity to bring this to, you know, lots of, and I mean, the American marketplace is the obvious one. Obviously, you're in California.
I'm in Los Angeles. Yes.
I mean, look at, you know, as I often say to the boys here, I said, you know, we're the only problem with smart students is we're in the wrong country in the world as such, you know.
I'll tell you where I'm at. I'm in Burbank. I can walk to NBC, ABC, Television, Disney, Universal, and Warner Brothers and DreamWorks. They're in my neighborhood. And a host, dozens of post houses are in my neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, that's our market. I mean, Bobby, yeah, that's exactly our marketplace, you know. And but we got to be realistic too. We can't afford. I don't even mean from a financial point of view, but we can't afford not to run out and offer something and then fail to deliver as such, you know.
Sure.
So, but that's a process that we're working on. You know, we've had some interesting contacts from people in your part of the world there, who have the construction expertise and have the construction abilities and what have you, and have a degree of experience in the studio marketplace. So we're discussing, slowly but surely discussing tactics with them, but it certainly is on our radar to you know, like, we spent a long time designing this. I think this particular smart studio, it's a child of the recession that kicked in Ireland back 2008, 2010, because we had a lot of time on our hands, and we are, our traditional construction industry people just simply fell off their perch. They were gone. And so we had to turn our attention to what I didn't think we would have any ever work back in again. I didn't think I'd ever work back in the studio business again. But I turned my attention to that, and here you go. So it's been a long time coming. We're actually working on patenting the system we have a patent in the UK and in Europe, and we're looking on one in the States. And we kind of got to let those things run their course. And then beyond that point in time, then we certainly would hope and expect to be active in the LA market, in you know, that California market, you know, within the next 2 to 3 years for sure.
Yeah, well, it's a great idea. I must admit, I was intrigued when I heard about it, when I looked at your website and the animation that you have, which is fantastic, which shows everything. And then I read through all the material and I thought, wow, this is really, it's Smart Studio. It really is.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it is at the end of the day. And it's as I said, it's something of a lot of hours and what have you. But, you know, it's all based on the pure fundamentals. You're going to get, philosophy is get control of the low frequency spectrum. And if you get control of the low frequency spectrum, then you don't have the harmonics sort of spewing out further up on the spectrum, and then you're finding a problem at 1K. But, you know, 1K is not probably the problem. It's 500, it's 250. It's probably 125 is where the problem is as such, you know. And that's what we find when we actually get control of the low frequency spectrum. It works, you know. Yeah. It really does work as such, you know. Fundamentals, always the fundamentals.
Last question, Jim. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe you learned along the way or someone imparted to you?
Okay, I suppose the best bit of business advice, is I certainly found that taking control of the situation, like buying a CNC machine, you know, taking control of the situation. Obviously, you need partners, you need other people around you and what have you, but I found that, conceiving, you know, you got to have something that's a little bit left of center, a little bit different. You know, me too companies always will survive, but always struggle. You got to find a slightly different angle. It's probably on the same team, you know, but it's our unknown team, but find a slightly different angle. You then got to commit to sort of researching that inside and out. And I think you got to commit to taking as much control of that as you possibly can. That means you got to have a small multidimensional team who can sort of understand where you want to go and who can work with you as such. And then be prepared for lots of surprises, some of them nice, some of them not so nice. And be prepared to put some money behind it and sort of say, look, at you know, we've just got to do this. Life is full of lots of learning opportunities, lots of experiences, some of them pleasant, some of them not so, but we all build up for, once you're on the right path, they all build to something very, very satisfying and worthwhile in the end.
You can find out more about Jim and Smart Studio at smartstudioinc.com. That's smartstudioinc.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, and now Radio Public. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyownercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.